This is the Larry Mueller Show on Wisconsin Public Radio. I am Jill Nadeau, and we're talking about a new documentary today that's focusing on the Green Bay, the Bay of Green Bay, and its ecosystem. It's called The Natural World of the Bay, and we've got two guests here with us in the studio to tell us all about it. Emily Tyner is Director of Freshwater Strategy at UW Green Bay, and Dan Larson is a solo filmmaker, and four of his documentaries have aired on PBS Wisconsin. And of course, we want to hear from you. What do you love about the Bay of Green Bay? How have you helped improve the ecosystem around the Bay? Call 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org with those questions or comments. Dan, Emily, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So, Dan, why did you feel it was important to tell this story?
Well, I have been interested in our area of northeast Wisconsin. I've been interested in the Niagara Escarpment, the lower Fox River, and I've done films on those. And then it was a natural for the third element, which is the Bay of Green Bay. And I thought that was something that I wanted to know more about. All I knew it was just a body of water with Lakers, some fishermen on it. I knew there had to be more stories there.
Yeah, well, you're right. Your instincts were definitely right, because you go into a lot of things that I know I have never even thought about. So was it hard to get people to come on? You've talked to a lot of people in this film.
Yeah, the first step was getting a base knowledge of it, and that's where Emily and the University of Wisconsin at Green Bay were very helpful. I spoke to them before I even took a shot or did an interview. I spoke to them, and they were very, very helpful in giving me a good understanding of it. And then as I got into it, I wanted to find stories around the circumference of the bay and in the bay. So stories that could kind of take somebody on a tour around the entire body of that water. And through the university and other ways, Fish and Wildlife Service, DNR of Wisconsin, the DNR of Michigan, all those were helpful players, basically, where I could find stories.
Okay. And Emily, why don't you tell us about Freshwater Strategy? I hadn't heard about it before. I apologize. But tell us what that is, and then how did you help Dan with this film?
Sure. So yeah, at the University of Wisconsin Green Bay, where I work, we have a campus on the water. We have four campuses on the water, actually, spanning from Marinette to Sheboygan, and a history of connection and work on the bay, engaging students and faculty members. Part of that has been cleanup of the lower bay. There's been a $1.5 billion cleanup effort of the Fox River. And we have this EcoU history, where the university's founding was born out of kind of an EcoU time and a focus on getting students and faculty engaged in hands-on water-related research. So we are now helping to revive that EcoU history and connecting with Dan and telling these stories of the bay as part of it. I think Northeast Wisconsin has so much to celebrate around water, and telling that water story and having that strong water identity is something that I and the university and Dan and others in the region really want to help promote and bring about. And this is kind of one of our big first steps in telling that story of we're sitting on an abundant source of fresh water, a water-rich area that comes with responsibility and stewardship potential, and how can we kind of better form those connections between community and people and this vast water resource that we're sitting under.
So you put a lot of money into cleaning up the bay, but it is huge in the economy of the area. So tell us some of the areas why it's so important.
Sure. Well, connection to water is important. We have our industry around Green Bay developed because shipping and having a western port in the Great Lakes. Now water recreation is huge. The fishing industry, kind of a reviving fishing industry with Great Lakes cleanup and restoration. There's better fisheries, improved fishery. And then there's also these kind of spiritual and cultural connections. People are drawn to water around the world, and the bay is part of that story. So increasing both kind of public access, so the bay is not just something that is something you look at, but you can be part of it. We want to increase public access points, that you don't have to only have a boat to be able to get on the bay. Let's have more public viewing sites. So for all those reasons, this video and then the rest of the work we're doing in Northeast Wisconsin to connect people to the bay is about that like kind of stronger identity around water.
And Dan, now we think Green Bay, we always think, okay, the city, all right. But we kind of think about the actual water, where it was named. The city was named for the bay, I'm assuming. Where did the name Green Bay come from?
Well, I guess the lushness of it is one story. Mm-hmm. It's just that southern area is very, very nutrient-based, even I think even before industry was there. It was just a richness to that area. Early maps of Green Bay show it as more of a V coming out of the Fox River, where now it's like a big U basin, so it's been heavily modified. But back in the day, I mean, it was just choked with wild rice. And the Native Americans, the First Nations, were heavily dependent on the wild rice. It became part of their cultures, especially with the Menominee and the Secaucus Chippewa. And you've got this huge flights of birds that are coming through. So it's just a natural magnet for those First Nations people to really have a civilization there.
I love that you added that to your film, too. That's part of it. So many aspects. Now, you call it the world, the natural world, and it really, really is. So just tell us a little bit about all the different aspects that you cover in the film.
Yeah, the world is critical, because when I first looked at it, I was thinking just of the bay, the water, the edge, you know, and into it. But then I quickly realized in talking like to the university people and biologists that it extends to the coastal wetlands. Huge importance with nutrients bringing in, taking out, filtering, the tributaries, the rivers and streams, how that is so critical for fish spawning, for fish to do well. And then also looking at the agricultural dominated watershed. I mean, all those nutrients are coming now off farm fields and that. What are ways that they're trying to retain those nutrients on the ground and not allow them to get into the water? So urban areas, another factor in that big complex equation. So those are the aspects that I felt really had to be looked at to get an entire world view of it.
And Emily, what are a few of the things that make Green Bay unique worldwide?
Sure. So Green Bay is a freshwater estuary, and I'll explain that term because I know it can be new for people. It was new for me when I started my job. So estuary is when you have two distinct water bodies mixing and meeting, and usually they're chemically distinct. In the case of Green Bay, you have the kind of cold, relatively nutrient-poor waters of Lake Michigan mixing with the nutrient-heavy, warmer waters of the Fox River. People might think of Chesapeake Bay. That's a world-renowned saltwater estuary. We have our own world-renowned estuary in Green Bay. It's considered one of the world's largest freshwater estuaries. Estuaries are important habitat for birds. As Dan mentioned, the Bay of Green Bay is a migration flyway for birds. Estuaries trap sediment so it doesn't kind of go out into the greater Lake Michigan. They protect coastal habitats from flooding. They are nursery grounds for fish and other kind of organisms out into the rest of the lake. So they provide many unique functions and functionalities. They have been changed over time because of development and infrastructure changes, but now we're trying to rebuild and regrow our estuaries. So we are, as I said, the world's largest freshwater estuary, and we want to celebrate that and tell that story with Dan and kind of shine a light on why it's so important and helpful to have such a great freshwater ecosystem in our backyard.
Now, you just mentioned that it was the biggest estuary, freshwater estuary. How big is Green Bay? Because, you know, in my mind, we had talked earlier that it kind of stops at the end of Door County, right? But it goes more, it's longer than that. It's bigger than that, right?
It's 120 miles long and 10 to 20 miles wide.
That's a big bay.
It is. And it's also the largest watershed is that Fox River watershed. So that's like with a 6,400 square miles of water, accumulating water coming into that Fox River.
How far up does it go?
Well, the lower Fox goes up to Menasha, Nina, but then you got the upper Fox above that, so that's a different watershed. And there's also the Wolf River watershed and then the Winnebago watershed, and all of those make up that larger Green Bay watershed.
Okay. And then the northern part of Green Bay itself is the UP, actually. Which I don't think we think about at all because, hey, there's a state line there.
Right.
So that goes up into the Little Beatty Knock, Big Beatty Knock.
Yep, you got Escanaba, you got Gladstone up there. Mm-hmm. You got the beautiful peninsulas, the Garden Peninsula, and then the Stonington Peninsula. Mm-hmm. And those are just very, I would call remote areas.
Yes.
I mean, wonderful places to visit. You're not going to see a lot of people when you do that. And it's just beautiful vistas everywhere you look.
Yeah. And as growing up there myself, I have to attest to that. But we won't go past that. But one of the things I thought was quite interesting is the work that they're doing with the whitefish as far as tagging them and sending them up following them. Can you explain that a little bit, Dan?
As far as I know, Green Bay is the one place on the Great Lakes where whitefish are doing well,
mm-hmm.
and primarily in an area below Chambers Island and south. Other than that, whitefish are struggling in the Great Lakes, but because Green Bay has this excessive nutrient base, there are areas where it's also very healthy for fish to be. So it's kind of like a two-edged sword, but the fish are able to figure that out, and the whitefish are tagged. There's a good story in there with Dan Iserman from UW Stevens Point, and he talks about the tagging of the fish, how they're studying them, and how the fish are basically looking for the nutrients and staying in those areas, and then looking for commonalities where they can maybe try and figure out ways to do adjustments to kind of get that population healthier.
Yeah, it's really fascinating how they're doing this. And you followed a lot of these researchers. How long did it take you to make this film?
Well, I started 3.5 years ago.
Okay.
It's been a long time. And it's great to be at this point, I got to tell you.
I'll
the
bet
finish
it is.
Line is this premiere coming up on the 22nd. And like, oh, man, I'm all in.
I'm sure everybody listening going, okay, fine, this sounds like a really good show. How do I see it?
Yeah, and Emily can jump in here too, but UW Green Bay is hosting it.
Okay.
It'll be on the 22nd at their facility, a theater hall. And Emily, I'll let you jump in to tell them more about that.
Sure. So in honor of Earth Day,
yes.
Next Wednesday, April 22nd, at 6 p.m., we are hosting Dan's premiere of Dan's film on our campus at University Theater on our Green Bay campus. Using this as a celebration of all things water. So before the event, we're going to have organizations that represent different actions in the watershed, waterfowl, bird watching, Citizens Climate Lobby. Dan will have a premiere for an hour, and then we'll do Q&As with the 40, we've invited the 45 storytellers.
Oh my gosh.
So many people that have told this story. Some of them will be there to come on stage and share what makes the base special and how they feel connected to it.
Mm-hmm. And then after that, what happens?
Well, then we're going to, the film is going to go to the Mulva Center in De Pere. And the
okay.
Mulva, it's called the Mulva Cultural Center. It's a wonderful facility. It's run by the Mulva Family Trust or that group. And they have a wonderful theater there. And they run movies throughout the day. It's going to go there. It's going to go in the rotation. And I must say they have one of the most beautiful, functionally screens there. It's just a wonderful screen. It's the whole wall.
Nice.
There's only like one of three in the country, and it's just a wonderful venue for it, and that would be a great place to go watch the film.
Okay, wonderful. Well, we are talking to Dan Larson, who's a solo filmmaker, and four of his documentaries have aired on PBS Wisconsin, and with him is Emily Tyner. She's director of Freshwater Strategy at UW Green Bay. If you've got any questions about the film or about the program at UW Green Bay, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Okay, we are back with our guests, Dan Larson, who is a filmmaker, and Emily Tyner, who is the director of the Freshwater Strategy Department, I guess you'd call it,
program.
Yeah, at UW Green Bay. And we're talking about the film, The Natural World of the Bay. Stay with us because quarter two, I believe, we've got Phil Pelletieri coming in to talk about insects. So he'll be with us in a little bit. But right now we're talking about the film. And Emily, you want to talk a little bit more about some things, so go right ahead.
Sure. Well, I first want to thank Dan for making this film.
Sure.
He could have chosen any subject around the environment, and he focused on the Bay of Green Bay. And this this focus is, I think, an important time for it. One, it's he decided to tell us what we just mentioned earlier, this whole story, not just stop at the water line. We know water does not obey state boundaries. It crosses it crosses into Michigan and into the Great Lakes and the rest of the tributary there. So I think that was a really important part of the story, is thinking about the whole part of the bay. And the bay has gotten a lot of attention in recent years because of restoration actions on the Fox River. The lower Green Bay, it's called an area of concern, an area where there's been intense environmental cleanup, remediation, restoration. The Menominee River got that too. But to kind of tell this whole celebration from north to south, that was really unique. And having all these diverse filmmakers, he brought in tribal perspectives, university perspectives, water utility, New Water, which is Green Bay's water utility, he brought in that perspective. I really appreciate the consideration for bringing in a range of voices, diverse voices, and thinking about these aspects of the story that don't always get kind of that prominence. And the timing of the film is also great because the university and the state is going through the designation of a National Estuary and Research Reserve for the Bay of Green Bay. So I mentioned before that it's the largest freshwater estuary in the world. We want to celebrate that. And so we're in a process now to join a network of other estuaries around the U.S., both freshwater and coastal. We'll be joining colleagues in Superior on this. And we're planning for designation probably in 2027. So this is one more step in kind of celebrating that Green Bay story and having us be more connected to other estuaries around the country.
And if you do get that designation, then what will that mean for the program, for
sure.
The Bay?
So this is a federal state program. It's non-regulatory, which is important. It's the partner is NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. We'll get federal funding and support to focus on four things: research, education, stewardship, and training. All of these reserves across estuaries in the U.S. focus on those. And there's a phrase I like to say that this program's focused on. It's locally relevant, nationally significant. So we'll be there to address local ecosystem challenges, things like harmful algal blooms, emerging contaminants, safe recreation, shoreline erosion from fluctuating Great Lakes levels. But also we have access to expertise, to national funding sources, to other reserves, to better help us solve kind of these local Green Bay, Lake Michigan challenges by having national expertise. So new education programs, new research programs, and kind of new exposure for the Bay of Green Bay and to kind of help tell our story, as I keep talking about.
Wonderful. So, Dan, there are a lot of challenges to Green Bay, as Emily had mentioned. Let's kind of look at some of those. And one of those, of course, is pollution. And you had brought in, which I really loved, was one of the was a farmer who is very, very well aware of some of the challenges that farming creates for the Bay. So tell us about him, some of the things he's doing and other farmers like him.
Right. And the farmer's a Derek Vandehei with New Horizons Dairy, and he's in the south of De Pere, and he's on one of the tributaries, the Apple Creek. And what he has done is taken a real aggressive stance of trying to keep roots in the ground all the time. So he does cover crops. He also has boundary crops around his fields so that any runoff would have to first pass through those. And the idea of roots in the ground is you can actually grow two plants at the same time. So he would have like a shallow plant, like a clover or something, and then he would put a corn into that. And they can run that pretty much up until the fall, and then in the spring, that ground is still covered with those plants, so you don't get as much excessive runoff. And he's passionate about farming. He's passionate about water quality. And it was just fun to get him to tell that story and to really show that there is different ways that you can control those runoff issues.
Are there other efforts on the Bay to control those runoff problems?
Sure. I'll highlight one from New Water, a water utility partner. They've taken a really, I'd say, progressive approach to preventing before you kind of get pollutants or nutrients to their water treatment system. They are working with farmers up in the watershed on mitigation strategies, things like the same kind of things that Dan was talking about. So the Bay of Green Bay only contributes about 2% of the volume of Lake Michigan, but a third of the nutrients, and phosphorus is one of them, other nutrients that are coming off from the land. So there's a disproportionate contribution from the Bay of Green Bay to the rest of Lake Michigan in terms of things that can change water chemistry or impact fish. But by taking these kind of progressive forward-thinking approaches up watershed, so not only focusing on what happens right at the boundary of where the lake meets the land, but we know that all of that is impacted by way, way miles up the watershed because water flows down and eventually goes out to the lake. By kind of working with farmers, working with other utilities, landowners, neighbors, that contributes to these kind of cleanup efforts for the Lower Bay. And in turn, that improves Lake Michigan, where eventually Green Bay's water ends up.
Mm-hmm. I love that the farmer you talked to said that it's important for farmers, too, that they understand the importance of this. So that makes a lot of sense. Now, another problem is invasive things, the fish, the plants, those darn little muscly things. So tell us a little bit about some of those efforts that you filmed.
Yeah, so there were three things that were followed. One was the sea lamprey, and that's more of an older story. They become of prominence in the 30s through the 50s, here where you get that horrible ability for these fish to destroy whole fisheries. So following a group that trapped them on the Peshtigo River for cataloging purposes to kind of get an idea what the numbers are, and then the treatment group, using the lamprecides to try and knock down that population on the Peshtigo River, and of course all the other rivers they do too in a certain rotation. The other invasive, which I think is the worst one, that's one you spoke of, is the quagga mussels, the zebra mussels, the dry scented category, and they've just devastated the bottom of all the Great Lakes, you know, and changed the whole, like the diaporia that used to be on the bottom, a very small, like a microscopic little critter that the fish would eat, an arthropod, those are gone now. So now fish are struggling to find different food sources, which is one reason the bay does so well, because it's got so much algae in it from the nutrients. But in other parts of the Great Lakes, it is a bigger problem. The invasive plants, we followed the European frogbit plant, which was part of like a water garden plant or an aquarium type plant, and how that got unfortunately released into the bay, and now it's in that Marinette, Menominee, Oconto area. So it's following that and what groups are trying to do to hold those back or try and at least, you know, get a handle on that destructive nature of those.
One of the things I noticed, Dan, that you not only talked to 45 people or however many, you covered so many topics, but you did them so well in that they were clear, like the lamprey. I've seen articles and books on these things, but you managed to get all the important things down in a matter of like 5 minutes, and it's clear, it's concise. How difficult is that to compress that all down into some, you know, these bite-sized pieces?
Well, you are onto something there. The first draft was over 4 hours.
Okay.
So then I just boiled it down to get to 59. But what I like to do is listen to what, after the interviews are done and mm-hmm. you're playing the tapes back and you're listening to the clips, is to just find similarities and tie them together. And I love the interview style. There's some narration in there. Cammie Rapson did a wonderful job with some narration to link areas. But I love to find the areas where people can have a comment and then somebody else can tag on to that. And then you can kind of build it and create a greater meaning from just that one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a puzzle, but it's kind of fun. But I have to say there are times when you're sweating it out and you're wondering, did I ask enough questions? Did they say enough of the right things?
Been there, done that, man. I appreciate that for sure.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, even with all those hours, you're like, oh, why didn't I ask that? That's right. So obvious, right?
Yeah, who was asking the questions?
And we don't hear your voice, do we?
No.
No. Do you do that on purpose?
I never put my voice in.
Oh, okay.
But I did put, there is one shot of me in there.
Is there?
I have one cameo. I'm holding a fish.
There are a lot of fish shots in this.
Fish and birds.
We know the fish lovers are among us, and we want to satisfy them.
Right. And I keep going, ew, they're touching all those fish.
Yeah.
Was it difficult to get some of those shots? Because, I mean, you're everywhere.
It takes time. Mm-hmm. It takes time. And you got to drive around, and sometimes you come up empty. But it takes time. Now, I must say I did have some help. Titus Selheimer from Sea Grant, UW Sea Grant, he mm-hmm. did give me some shots of the sturgeon underwater and the northern pike.
Oh, okay.
So we're very grateful for that. Mm-hmm. He was wonderful in sharing them, and he's in the film. He does a great piece in the sea lamprey section. But a lot of it is just you put the time in, and you cross your fingers, and you find stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, Emily, how can people that are listening help the efforts of, you know, the Green Bay area?
Absolutely. Well, that's one thing I appreciate about Dan's film is he ended on a note of where's the action and how do we think about the future?
Yeah.
We don't want to end these like with people feeling down, or there's lots of things to celebrate, lots of restoration, good stories to tell. So I think there's a scale of kind of being a contributing steward to the Great Lakes, from small, something that's happening on your own yard, to quite large. At a kind of local homeowner level, things like reducing runoff from both your lands, agricultural lands, urban areas. When you are thinking about the kind of plants and you put into your garden, going for native species and not just ornamental species, but thinking about things that are native to our region.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a boat owner, we mentioned people that love fishing, consider practicing clean boating practices, which means cleaning boats, cleaning out bait buckets. So when you're moving your boat from lake to lake, you're not mistakenly or inadvertently transferring aquatic invasive species, especially if you're going from the big lakes to smaller tributaries or smaller lakes where those invasive species haven't already colonized. Thinking about minimal fertilizer and pesticide use, if you're doing leaves, you're raking your leaves in the fall, keeping that out of drains and pipeways that eventually lead out to the lake. And then at kind of larger levels, the kind of next stage up your community level, I think about volunteering for activities that do cleanup efforts, especially to reduce plastic pollution. Microplastics is a real new, well, it's probably always been there, but now it's more recognized as an emerging concern. The EPA is now looking at it as a contaminant in drinking water. We know that microplastics are in every water body, even the bottom of Lake Michigan, bottom of the ocean. So trying to reduce plastic use and then cleaning up plastic through local waterway cleanups, adopt a lake, adopt a river things. And at the largest scale, I think I always like to support conservation organizations and actions. Things like Healing Our Waters, the Great Lakes Coalition. In Green Bay, there's a new effort called the Community Waters Coalition that's better connecting citizens to the water and having a voice in restoration priorities. And then one big thing is advocating for the Great Lakes for federal and state investment. The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative has been a multi-billion dollar, decade-plus effort that I think has been the most single-handedly biggest thing in the last 10 years to clean up, restore, invest, care about the Great Lakes. It's been really bipartisan the last 10 years, so encourage your legislators at a federal level to keep supporting the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, and our state legislators have been really great at that. The last thing I'll say is there's a book called Death and Life of the Great Lakes by Dan Egan. It's a really great comprehensive story of the history of Great Lakes. I encourage everyone to read that if they want to learn more. Watch Dan's film and then read other Dan's book.
All the same day.
It is an excellent book.
It is one of the best
stories. Oh, yeah, I agree. Yeah,
it wonderful. Is, actually, and we've talked to Dan about it. Okay. So, yeah, if anybody wants to Google it, you can listen to that interview with Dan. It was quite informative. And if you want to talk or ask a question of either one of our guests, give us a call, 800-642-1234. You can always send an email, of course, that's talk@wpr.org. We're talking about these things that are making things better. Are you optimistic, Dan? You've been in this area for a while. You've been doing these wonderful films. Are you optimistic about the way things are changing?
Yeah, I am. Mm-hmm. And I think it's that Clean Water Act of 1972 that was pivotal for people to recognize the importance of, you know, of taking a step.
Sure, absolutely.
It was a question that I did ask some of the biologists, and most of them said they wouldn't be in their field if they didn't think it wasn't positive of mm-hmm. what could happen. Now, some also said we were kind of in the fence in a couple categories, but I think it's optimistic.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when I see the videos of those mussels on the floor of the bay, that's got to be so discouraging because that's all you see. It looks like barnacles on the bottom of a boat. I mean, it's so bad. So what are some of the things they're doing for stuff like that?
Well, I would say that there are some ways that fish are learning to eat those, or okay. the veligers. That's like the larval form of the dry-scented mussels. Mm-hmm. So some fish are learning to eat that. There's not very many calories in it. You know, it's like eating celery instead of a Snickers bar. But there is some change in the ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I can add, my advisor from graduate school, Dr. Harvey Bootsma, at the School of Freshwater Sciences at UWM, he's working on a project now where they're focusing on kind of small areas and removing mussels and then seeing what happens. You couldn't do that across the whole lake, but you could do it at targeted areas. Like, for example, reef habitats where fish spawn, you might want to clear mussels so there's not a lot of predation on those baby fish. So I think these targeted efforts on small areas to remove, to kind of help fish populations. Like, I worked on mussels for my whole master's degree. I spent lots of time with them in the lab, in the field, scuba diving with them. So I know them intimately well. And they have re-engineered the Great Lakes, certainly. But with re-engineering comes new things like fish kind of starting to eat them, and then new ways of adapting and dealing with them, like scraping. And there's something called Zequinox, which is a chemical treatment you can use on small lakes. So there's new innovations around this.
They're working on it. We did get an email from Bruce. He's a lifelong Bay resident, has been greatly involved as a volunteer working on Bay issues, especially with Ducks Unlimited. Dan and Emily, thanks for shining under the light. Thanks for shining the light under the basket as to what's happening in the Lower Bay and highlighting its history. Bruce says he's seen great improvement in water quality in the last 50 years, but we always have a way to go. So thank you, Bruce, for that. You know, speaking of fish, you know, people are always wondering, okay, how are the fish doing? You know, what's going on with those fish? We talked a little bit about whitefish, but there are certainly plenty of others out there.
Well, one story is the walleye. Yes. At one point, like when the bay was suffering from, or the Fox River was suffering from industrial pollution, the primary walleye source was up in Little Bay to Knock.
Yes.
It was a huge walleye fishery, and like if you put like a certain quantity on the bay, most of it was up there. Now it's changed because the dry scented mussels have reduced all those nutrients in the upper part of the bay. The primary walleye fishery is now in the south, off the Fox River. But the quantity of the walleye have stayed pretty much the same. It's just that it's shifted from north to south now. So those mussels cheat and they eat those nutrients off the bottom. But in the southern portion, there's so much algae in that they can't consume it all, so the fish get somewhat of a leg up there.
So things are just kind of moving.
They have.
Which is kind of what nature does, right?
This isn't really there's not a fishery on it as much, but sturgeon, which are kind of emblematic Great Lakes fish, yeah. Charismatic megafauna, they spawn and they use kind of Fox River for that. A colleague of mine at the university, Chris Houghton, just a few seasons ago, they've been tagging sturgeon and watching them come back. And by the De Pere Dam, they caught a sturgeon that they released again. It was 7 feet long. And they were imagining how old and long that lake sturgeon has been swimming around the Great Lakes. I saw a story around the Milwaukee tributary of sturgeon kind of coming back after they've been released. There's all these kind of small stories that are coming together as a bigger story as the Great Lakes are being restored and rehabilitated. Sturgeon, this iconic species, is doing well, and that's really exciting to think about this change. So when you're talking about a positive outlook and thinking towards the future, I really see these stories as a way to be hopeful about changes coming, positive changes coming.
That is good news. We have a call from Bob in Green Bay. Go ahead, Bob.
Yes, I'd like to know what the guests think of the city of Green Bay is considering reestablishing a beach at Bay Beach Park in Green Bay, and what their thoughts are on that, and whether it's a good idea or maybe something for farther down the road.
Okay, great. Thanks, Bob. Who wants to take that first?
I can take that first. Yeah. As I mentioned earlier, I really think public access and access to the water is really important. That's how you instill stewardship and get kind of the next generation of residents connected to the bay. And I do know the city is interested in reestablishing a swimming beach. There was historically a swimming beach in the Lower Bay. One persistent concern is harmful algal blooms. So getting a handle on when and where is the worst times. We know that it's not bad all the time. So one thing we're working on at the university is better models to understand, are there certain days where you really shouldn't be out there swimming? And are the other days where even if the color maybe is a little green, it's perfectly fine. So I think continued investment and understanding of the conditions that promote harmful algal blooms is the way to kind of get to swimmable understanding of having a swimmable beach waters. Mm-hmm. But I all for what the caller said about having other public access points up the beach, just more ways for people to get on the water, in the water, whether it be through swimming, through piers for fishing, for park benches to do sunset watches, all of those things help with that stewardship mindset.
Mm-hmm. One thing we didn't talk about too much is birds. And that's kind of been a neat story too. If you could talk a little bit about some of the birds that are back and using the area.
Yeah, one great story is the Cat Island restoration. It had been washed away in the 60s and 70s, and they rebuilt the island. They took the basic core of it that was still on the water bottom, and then they built it up with gravel and big rocks. And then they used dredge spoilings to fill it in. And almost instantly, birds started being drawn back to it in just huge numbers. And because it was on this big, long island, it could be protected from some of the land-based predators. And pelicans are nesting there. You got cormorants. You got seagulls. The piping plover are there in a sandy section. And it's just amazing that this turnaround with this land that is in fairly pristine shape and beautifully restored.
Yeah, I can't say enough about the Cat Island Restoration Project. This is one of those stories of both economic value because the dredge spoils are what they use to clear out the Green Bay shipping channel to make sure that ships can come through. And then putting them and then having this restoration solution, like rebuilding these islands that were so important as barrier islands to protect wetland habitat back on shore. And then the way that birds have responded, like almost immediately piping plovers, these cute, federally protected, tiny, tiny little birds started nesting there. And now we have nesting pairs every season. Just last week, the first piping plover of the season was spotted on the island. And it just really kind of shows you when you have kind of restoration communities working with economics, with the local utilities, with the county executives, you can have these great stories of success.
Wonderful. Well, I want to thank you both for sharing the film, number one, and your excitement for what's going on in the Green Bay with us and our listeners. And one more time, where can people see the film?
Sure. The film is going to be premiered at UW Green Bay's campus on Wednesday, April 22nd at 6 p.m. at University Theater. We invite anyone to come out and enjoy the film with us, meet Dan, meet me, meet other speakers in the film, and learn about the Green Bay ecosystem.
And then after that?
It goes to the Mulva Center in De Pere, and it's going to be in the rotation for probably 2 or 3 months.
Wonderful. Emily and Dan, thank you so much again for being with us. Emily Tyner is Director of Freshwater Strategy at UW Green Bay, and Dan Larson is a solo filmmaker. Up next, of course, Phil Pelletieri is going to be with us to talk about insects. So stay with us.